Honorable members, and compliments for the new season. We'll basically start with the brief introduction, and then we'll explain to you as to how we're going to continue or proceed with this briefing today. Thank you. Okay. I'm J.B. Sibanyoni, chairing the ad hoc committee, but on the side of the National Assembly, the lower house.
Tunka Madila, co-chairperson from the NSOP.
With the honourable members of parliament who are members of this ad hoc committee, just introduce yourself.
Jefferson Morning, yes, I'm Wendy Nelson, serving on this ad hoc committee. Thanks.
I'm Pumzile Ngwenya Mabila, the member of this ad hoc committee.
Maybe just to get an indication whether we are representative, you just indicate from which party you are.
And which house.
And which house, also to see that it's really a multi-party ad hoc committee.
Okay, I'm deployed by the ANC to the lower house and then also to this committee. Thanks, Chair.
I'm the NA member representing the ANC.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Zukiswa Ranto, NCOP. I'm an ANC member.
Nomonde Hasmeni, NCOP, ANC.
Hey, Dumelang, Nake Oma, Borodo. Kerumiweki ANC, go NCOP, and I'm a member of this ad hoc committee. Thank you.
Sanbonani, Gabriel Ndabandaba, member of this committee, African National Congress.
I'm Luana Landers. I represent the African National Congress and the National Assembly.
Abstain, Mina Sheila Shope Sithole, ANC. National Assembly.
Sound like a Mupango.
Ralocha, Hotel Limpopo Province, Gurumileke ANC, ke member of NCOP, Limilaka Gemas for Gorihale, Ivileke member of Contrales.
Yes, I'm Nick Wernoff, member of the National Assembly and from Cape.
Gentlemen from the Justice Minister.
Chairperson, good morning. My name is Dion Rudman, Deputy DG, responsible for legislation in the Department of Justice.
I'm J. Cops Kosana, JB, in the Policy Unit of the Department, responsible for policy development.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once more. To this briefing that we are going to be having today. Let me just explain that we will start with the briefing because there are some changes that will take place. If you look at the advert, welcome. 15 minutes. I was about to start, but because I didn't start, let us complete the introduction. We're busy with the introduction.
Steve Swart from the ICDP. Thank you, Chair.
Dean Smuts from the DA, and both of us are sitting in the Protection of Information Bill where there is a 15-minute adjournment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I will try to be brief so that you benefit before you leave, because I know you are going to leave, but you need to benefit from the the briefing that J.B. Skhosana is going to do before he deals with the code. You'll recall that immediately after the appointment, the copies of this code, were distributed, but it would appear it didn't reach all members. As a result thereof, J.B. Skhosana is going to devote some time in explaining the code, etc. And then I was saying on the time when you were coming in that there are some changes that are going to take place. The duty of the ad hoc committee was advertised as going to be dealing with the code for the judge's conduct as well as the regulations for registrable interest. But without any waste of time, I would like to head it over to Skhosana to explain that there is some request that this multi-ad hoc committee should rather deal with the code for judges' conduct first, but keep the regulations in abeyance because of some engagements between the ministry and the judiciary. After they were tabled, there were some discussions which were drafted by the judiciary. The minister needs to look at that before we finally proceed with this. Ms. Skhosana, it's your time. Maybe just you will expand on what I've been saying.
Thank you, Honourable Chairs. We welcome this opportunity to share with the Honourable Parliament around these very important pieces of legislation. Just to start by basically explaining what the Chair is saying around the regulations. You'll notice that from the Act, the Minister had to table both the Code for Judicial Conduct and regulations on judges' registrable interest within 4 months after the Act came into operation. The Act came into operation on the 1st of June 2010, and by the 1st of November, the minister was obliged to table the code and the regulations. You'll also realize that the Act itself, the JSC Amendment Act, had been enacted in 2008. We had time between June and November to finalize the set of code and regulations. In terms of the Act, the Chief Justice compiles the code. The minister compiles the regulations. But the Act required the two to act in consultation with each other. It requires a concurrence between the two. The minister is assigned the responsibility of the regulations, the Chief Justice the responsibility of the code, but both of them must agree on the content. And the Act also further states that should there be a point of non-agreement between the two versions of each must be tabled for this Parliament, for Parliament to deal with them. We did not want to burden Parliament to take over a responsibility of a deadlock breaking mechanism. We wanted Parliament to remain a legislative institution. So we have said only one set of the code was tabled, and the regulations was tabled. The code and regulations tabled on the 1st of November. They were still in the draft at the stage because the discussions were still continuing between the minister and the Chief Justice and the heads of court and the judiciary. In December, the Chief Justice and the heads of court made request for certain legislative amendments to the Act, which would affect the regulations. And those proposed amendments were received late in December and discussed with the minister early this year, etc. The minister is still applying his mind on the proposed requests. And the minister thought it would then be appropriate for him to approach Parliament and request Parliament to give him the opportunity to consider those proposed amendments on the Act, which have an impact on the regulations. It's not going to be an open-ended process. The minister, there's a meeting scheduled for February of the heads of court and the minister, where those draft amendments are going to be discussed on the 13th of February after the opening of Parliament. And immediately thereafter, the minister will then be able to apply his mind on the request and will then advise Parliament accordingly in terms of moving forward around that aspect. A letter has been drafted, it's on the minister's table, addressed to the speaker and the chairperson of the NCOP, basically to convey that request. And we thought it, while the minister is considering that request and while the engagement are continuing around the regulations, it may be appropriate and important that the code be proceeded with. Hence, the request would then be that the code be commenced with earnest whilst the Parliament give us the space and time for the Minister to consider the request from the Chief Justice and the Judiciary before moving on, etc. I would basically like to state that those proposed amendments are in relation to the applicability of the Act on retired judges and the definition of the household of a judge in terms of declaring financial interests. So those are the two key aspects that made suggestion that the minister may want to reconsider or to look at in terms of amendments. And there was that request before this house. And if the chairperson of the house allows us to do so, we can then proceed with the code. Yes.
Yes, you can proceed. You know, as he speaks, he reminds me, he's a former magistrate. I used to appear before him. So as he was speaking, and his voice and the like, the old memories come back. Okay, Mr. Skosana, you can proceed.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to give a brief background in the code. I think this is a very important piece of legislative instrument that had, that Parliament has to deal with. And I think the fact that it has been before table for Parliament today compensates the time it has taken for us to be here. We'll all understand that members of the executive, public officials, everybody have long been the business of declaring their interest and of having their codes of conduct, to regulate their conduct. We have not had any for the judges because of the consultative process and because of the fact that there had to be legislation in place that need to provide a framework for that. So this is in compliance of Section 108 of the Constitution, which required Parliament and national legislation to provide for a comprehensive complaints handling mechanism in relation to the judiciary. The Act was passed in 2008, but in the absence of the code, it had remained toothless.
Thank you.
So I was still giving a background that we came a long way in terms of where we are. The constitutional and legislative framework provides for the code of conduct, and the code of conduct basically comprises a comprehensive complaints handling mechanisms against the judicial officers. In the absence of the code, in the absence of any complaint mechanism, it has been very difficult, both for the Judicial Service Commission or for any other structure, even Parliament, to deal with any act which is unbecoming of the office of a judicial office also. And I think this important piece of legislation for the first time going to provide a clear framework in terms of which complaints can be lodged by any other person, not only by the JSC and not only by the judges, but also by members of Parliament, by members of public, by any other structures, etc., against the conduct of working of the courts and the judiciary, etc. And there will then be clear mechanisms known for everybody in terms of which that will be dealt with. So in the presentation, I will also give the key principles that guide the code that has been tabled. We'll also give a summary of the code in terms of the rules and principles in the code. We'll also give a brief overview of how the Office of the Chief Judge is going to administer the code, and obviously we'll give some comments and a conclusion on how we see the process unfolding from our side, etc. As I've said, there are basically fundamental principles that guide the codes. From the international perspective, the Union Bangladesh Principle of Judicial Conduct provides for the establishment of principles that regulate ethical standards of judges, in view of the fact that they occupy quite a sensitive and delicate position, and it is necessary that they adhere to certain standard of conduct, and that were taken over in terms of with those Bangladesh principles that have been embedded in the legislation which I've referred to. This is the Judicial Service Commission Amendment Act of 1994, which was amended in 2008 by this new comprehensive legislation, etc. The Constitution requires the appointment of an appropriately qualified woman or man who is fit and proper. The how we articulate the fit and properness is how basically the person who occupies office had to respond in terms of the issues of intelligence, the issues of diligence, the issues of conduct, the issues of respect, integrity, etc. All those aspects basically creates the office of this judicial officer. And it's very difficult for everyone to expect those aspects to be present from a judicial officer if they are not stated anyway. So the code of conduct, for the first time, it will state what do we expect of judges as ordinary people, litigants who appear before judges, etc. And at least people will have the opportunity to understand and expect what they should get from the judiciary at the end of the day. The Constitution enjoins organs to assist and protect the courts to ensure their independence, impartiality, and effectiveness. Impartiality and independence are very critical aspects which permeate the entire code, so that at the end of the day, people are satisfied with the quality of justice they receive from the judicial officers, etc. I've talked about the Judicial Service Commission Amendment Act of 2008, and I've reiterated the fact that that act remains toothless until such time that can be put into operation, and can only be put into operation if, one, there's a code, and two, people and everybody are able to activate and to react in terms of the code, etc. So the act and the code seeks to create a balance between the independence and dignity of the judiciary, and also considering complaints that may come from all the quarters, and so that those complaints are dealt with through any process which is transparent, which is open, and which exerts accountability as articulated by the Constitution. I've said that the Chief Justice must draft the code, the Minister must draft the regulations. The code that has been presented has been drafted by the Chief Justice, and we will give basically our views in terms of the code as I present, as well as I give the summary of the code, etc. The key principles that guide the codes are in the Constitution, but some of them require emphasis. The rule of law. The courts are the guardian of the Constitution and the rule of law. Everybody expects that everything that happens at the courts in accordance with the law, and all those principles of independent accessibility are present when the courts deal with our functions. Key around all these aspects is the whole issue of judicial accountability. Judicial officers, like all other members who are entrusted with public power, take an oath to protect and achieve your constitution, and the code of conduct amplifies the process. Equality is central to everything that we do. Looking at the history where we come from, access to justice is very important. People can only have public confidence in the system if they believe in the quality of justice being delivered to them. And for them to be able to do so, they have to be satisfied that the judiciary is basically conducting itself in terms of the constitution and the law that applies to the country. based on the principles of Article, therefore, that the Chief Justice, we have a code that reflects the views of the judiciary expressed by the Chief Justice and the Heads of Courts. The Minister and the Department mainly provided technical assistance and guidelines in the code, because we left the drafting process to be done by the judiciary. And we are very hopeful that this Parliament will help refine whatever shortcomings that may exist in the code or so, understanding that judges themselves are not used to drafting law, they are used to writing judgments. So the product as presented may not meet in all respect the requirement of law itself, but surely we were dependent on Parliament to guide us in that process. And I think it was very important that the legislation requires Parliament to approve the code at the end of the day. I've said that there was no desirability or intention on the part of the Minister to draft another code for Parliament. So we think that the same code that's presented will basically be the framework within which we will move forward here as Parliament. In terms of the style, drafting style, you will notice the code, which I'll go through, is that it has subheadings. Under every subheading, it got the rules. It states what must happen, what must not happen. Under each rule, there's a note. That note, the judiciary out of the view, or they intend with that note that it should assist in the interpretation of the rule, which is obviously a new innovation and unprecedented elsewhere. But the good thing about it is that it contains some of the aspects which, in our view, should be contained in the rules themselves, and Parliament can guide the process as we move towards. So the fact that the judiciary put them in the note themselves is very encouraging, because it means that they already agree or concede those principles to be contained in the code. Now I'm going to, when I going through the summary of the code, I'm going to suggest to the chairperson that I do it in dual way. That is, I refer to the code, which I suppose members of Parliament have in their position, so that we also save the time, and also those who may not have enough time to have gone through the code themselves, etc. So when we look at the code, there's a preamble at the beginning, and the preamble of the code is kind of restate the cultural values and principles enshrined both in the legislation and as some of the principles of our legal system, the whole principles of independence, the whole issue of judicial accountability, and also the need to create a balance between ensuring the dignity of the judiciary and also ensuring that the complaints are dealt with diligently and in open and transparent ways. So the preamble is very long, but basically it rehearses the principles. That's what it does, and most of the aspects there are taken from the constitution themselves. There's always a view from some of the drafters that it's not necessary that you reiterate and repeat what is known from the constitution. But I think the judges had put it there basically just to show emphasis that they uphold those principles, etc. So we may not basically take time around the preamble. Under the first subheading, application. And basically, application in the code basically underscores the fact that any breach of this code warrant or justify a complaint against the judge, which is very fundamental. For the first time now, if this code has been published and people realize that what has been written in the code has been breached by a particular judge, any person is entitled and may go to a police station and lay a complaint in an affidavit or statement against the judge. If, for example, in the code it said that a judge must give judgment within a reasonable time before the end of the term, or if the allegations that a judge has acted in a manner that compromised his or her impartiality, signed with the other person, etc., other than the normal appeals, whatever, etc., when the complaint is not against the case, but against the person, the individual can basically lodge a complaint as provided for in the Act, etc. In our view, we thought that obviously it's important that issue of application may be extended also to apply to categories of judges who are affected by the code. But that's aspect that Parliament may further guide us on moving forward. The second aspect, subheading, is interpretation on the code. And that's what I was leading to. When you look at the code, the code explains all the necessary guidelines that may be taken into account in interpreting the provisions of the code. They also, on page 4, it also makes reference to the laws drafted in addition to the rules, and they are intended to guide and provide explanation with respect to the purpose and meaning of the rules. These notes are very important, which means should there be dispute in terms of that contravention, should there be a complaint which must be dealt with, they may have to rely on the rules to give a clear explanation or clarity on the rule provided for, etc. We found them very useful. However, Parliament may want them to be drafted in a particular way to reflect their intention, etc. And as I said, there are those which we think they need to be part of the body of the document rather than to get the laws themselves. There's judicial independence under 3, which are very known, etc. And I think those three aspects on the code speak for themselves. The judge must not be influenced by any external forces, or the executive, etc. Must act independently and with impartiality, and the integrity of the judicial must at all times be maintained, etc. You will note that under...
I'm sorry for interruption. If maybe you don't find it, some of the documents are not compiled properly. As for example, it starts with an application. But if you want the section on interpretation, or page 3 thereof, if you can page through towards the middle, you will find that page 3, which says interpretation. All the documents that are here, but it would appear that when the copies were made, there were some a little bit of some mistakes. Thank you, Skosana. Sorry for the interruption.
I apologize for that. under judicial independence, you'll notice that, as I've said, the judge must uphold the independence and integrity. The judge must not have influence or favor, or must not act in a way that suggests is favorable to any particular person or is got influence of any particular groups or executive, etc. And that is very key to the independence of the judiciary. We will note under independence that there's a note under 3.1 and 3.B. 3.1, judge acts fearlessly and according to his own conscience, because the judge is only accountable to the law. Judge do not pay any heed to political parties or pressure groups, or perform all penal duties from outside influence, which means that judges must only take instructions from any political parties, etc., or from any organization that may influence the outcome of the case. Judge do not appear at public hearings before, otherwise consult or with executive other non-members of law. Judges are not expected to participate in processes that have got that makes general opinion in terms of the status of a particular aspect, except when the event is about the law or is about the legal system. Surely the judge can come here and engage with ourselves in terms of law and the dispensation, whatever, but judge may not be seen to be participating in other outside aspects which influence particular positions at the end of the And judicial independence is a private right or a principle for the benefit of judges as individuals. It is a process which must guide them in the execution of their own functions, etc. So what we are basically in terms of our view is that some of the principles contained in the notes themselves are so fundamental that needs reflection in the body itself. Under sub 4, judge to act honorably. It's given that honesty and integrity is very central to office for judicial officer, because the real purpose of a judicial officer is to make sure that it deals with those who are found to be in contravention of the law, who have acted in a manner that suggests dishonestly, etc. So you cannot expect that a dishonest judicial officer be put in charge of dealing with that kind of dispute, etc. So in terms of their behavior, in terms of their professional and private lives, whether on the bench or outside the bench, they must basically reflect that kind of expectation from them by members of society, etc. Number five, comply with the law. It's very straightforward. Judge is expected to abide with the law. It's not expected of judge to be appearing from time to time at court before their colleagues for infringement of the law. They're expected to help manage those who infringe the law, etc. And now, if you can look at point note 5.6, offences involving moral turpitude are also inexcusable. It means that even if the particular conduct is not outlined, is not prescribed as an offense per se, but it boils around of morality. Because judges are expected to behave in a particular way. They expect to conduct a particular decorum, integrity, etc. They should desist in any conduct which put the entire system into disrepute. Aspects of equality are very fundamental. Under six, and surely they speak for themselves. And there were views that some of the aspects which they have raised here are only part of a legal system, but we've also acceded to the point that the fact that they've been rehashed is not harmful to the code itself. If the judges have taken some of their laws and right in terms of emphasizing aspects that they want to concentrate on in terms of their own conduct, to extend that may not be in contravention of the law, we found it not very harmful to the court itself. Fair trial, under 8. And there was also a view that fair trial is already a legal principle articled elsewhere in law. People know that for a fair trial to take place, accused must be given the opportunity to cross-examine, etc. But the judges feel that we need to have an emphasis so that even where these principles are contravened by any particular judicial officer, there could be a recourse to those who are affected by the conduct, etc. And therefore, if you read that rule, it says a judge resolves dispute by making findings of fact and applying the appropriate law in a fair hearing. This includes the duty to observe the letter and spirit of the Audi Altram rule, to remain impartial and give adequate reason for any decisions. We know that there are, and this is very important, because we know that in practice, judges are only entitled to give reasons where people have law and appeal, whatever, etc. This provides gives an onerous task on the judicial officers that where reasons, even where there are no appeals, whatever, in all cases, judges must, because they are ruled against person, they must give reasons for their judgment. It's very fundamental, because that can even help the people to decide whether they need to take the matter further or whether they're satisfied, etc. And this is a more important aspect that amplifies and adds to our legal system, etc. And we should be welcomed by all kind of, all in sundry. Now on page 8, the judge manages legal proceedings in such a way as to expedite our conclusion as cost-effectively as possible and does not shift the respondent to hear and decide on a matter to another judge. Very important. The judges must be conscious and sensitive to the cost that people are engaged in bringing the matters before court. It is not only that the judges must listen and be guided by the parties as well. The judges must be sensitive to the fact that people have paid to come to court. Either they've paid a lot of cost to get lawyers to come and represent them, or they've traveled long distance to come and have their matter resolved. So when they deal with those aspects, they must keep them at the back of mind. And all these are new innovations, because they were never there. In most instances, it is not required of judges to understand the interface relationship between themselves and the attorneys and what they've paid, etc. And this brings them to be sensitive to those aspects for the first time. And this will bring, which means, an ordinary person is eligible to ask the judge, as a judge, I would wish the matter to get finished as soon as possible, because this is the cause it cost me. I'm on the verge of losing my employment due to postponements, whatever. And the judge must be sensitive to those aspects, etc. it changes the system, because all the time the judges have been inquisitorial, they've been seen to be adversarial. They remain very impartial, waiting for the parties to argue and want to come and settle. So this provides an obligation on the judge when the prosecutor wants to postpone a criminal case, or when the attorney wants to postpone a civil matter, the judge must inquire why the reason for the postponement, and this protects civil, the ordinary people, and is very central to access to justice. Under the notes, there are notes which have been given there to give effect to those parties. Note B8C, it says that the judge has the right to write judgments in a style and merit just things best. At the heart of the judge has the necessity to make findings as to people's motive, credibility, honesty, and competence. The judgments that judge writes must be acceptable to the people they apply to. Even if they write them in the way they think best, it's important that they are understood by those to whom they are referred to, etc., so that they can go, the person will serve a sentence or will pay whatever if they can understand the judgment correctly, etc. It must not be a discourse or a discussion between the judge and those who are learned friends, the attorneys and the lawyers, to the exclusion of the very same persons affected by the judgment, etc. And I think in terms of letter judgment writing, it's very central that those aspects be brought to light. A judge may not, under guise of conventional functions, make defamatory or derogatory statements actuated by personal spite, ill will, or improper, unlawful, ulterior motives. These aspects are so important that, because in the normal course of events, they are not appealable. So when a judge, when on the bench, behaves in a way that is derogatory, but still applies the law, you don't have any recourse, because we can only apply on the facts or on the law. You cannot only appeal on the facts or on the law. You cannot appeal on the demeanor or conduct to a judge, because those things are not kept on record. We come from a dispensation where when we bought the machines for the judge, when they're operating them, they will listen, when they want to utter those words, they'll switch off. Well, that's not on the record. And then went on top of the attorney or even the accused person, etc. Then thereafter press on, etc. And those are the problems we come from, etc. Because they knew very well that their peers will take them up on what they say. Now that the system we've created, the courts today, this system is so sophisticated that nobody can control on it. When the court starts, it records everything that happens in the court. Nobody could control, because an IT system, etc. And that system also helps people to behave in a particular way, etc. And where the system is not appearing, where the system is not effective, people have got their recourse. They can take it up with the judge and say, look, I was insulted, or I felt I was defamed by the conduct, etc. The fact that an accused person, the fact that you happen to be in a court, does not make you a less person. Then the judge more important. It still gives you the opportunity to be corrected by the judge, and the judge must play its role as part of nation building at the end of the day. Diligence is very critical, because that's where aspects of time come into being. And in court, the most expensive thing is time. A postponement is costly. And the sooner the matter is expected and finalized, the better to all that appears before court, etc. People may not know what is the cost of justice in real terms. Not only in terms of the government is always concerned about the money paid for judges. We are not conscious of the money that people pay to come to court. And people pay attorneys to come to court, etc. An ordinary application to go through the court, as a high court, would not cost you anything less than 150,000, 300,000. That's why people used to come to say that for you to get access to justice, it's either you are too rich or too poor. Because if you are too rich, you stand for yourself. If you are too poor, legal aid will stand for you. If you are in between, nobody cares about you. And those are people who don't have access to justice, etc. And we can, from our side, we can help the system by making sure people spend as little time as they have to spend when they come to court. And the judges must make sure that happens, etc. Now, under 9.1, a judge performs all assigned duties diligently, investigates the matter at hand thoroughly, and disposes of the business of the court promptly and in an efficient and business-like manner. Judge must be must be sensitive of the time of people have taken to come to be to appear before him, etc. And that also gives the judges the power, the authority to call to order those who may be delaying the legal process for their own personal interest or personal gains, etc. A judge gives judgment or any ruling in a case promptly and without due delay. If you have appeared before court, you are entitled to a judgment. A judge does not engage in the conduct that is prejudicial to effectiveness and expeditious action of justice or business of the court. Now, and all those are very central, and I tell you, there are going to be issues that people are going to raise up immediately the court becomes published. Because every time the complainant faces the court, it's justice delayed, it's justice denied. Judge attends chambers during normal office hours and attends to court during normal court hours, unless such attendance is not required in order to perform any official duties. All official duties are to be performed properly, timely, and in an orderly manner. A judge respects and complies with admissive requests of the head of court or the relevant senior judge. Now, why is the latter part very, very important? Very, very important. It's because in terms of the culture of the judiciary and the independence of the judiciary, they find it very, very difficult to follow orders of their peers, whatever, because they're independent and their constitution, they must be independent from other judges, etc. So it becomes very difficult to call orders and to manage a proper control or performance management in a usual terminology or concept, etc. This now provides an opportunity for senior judges and head of court to manage the performance of other judges. A senior judge or a judge president will be entitled to inquire and to intervene if he or she has reason to suspect that proceedings are delayed unnecessarily, without the need to go through the appeal or go to the High Court, etc. Because if those proceedings are not here, there's no recourse for ordinary people to take up the matter, etc. If you are frustrated with the judge that you are appearing before, etc., you appear powerless. You don't have any other means because you cannot go to appeal court because the matter must first be finalized. And now the senior judge are given the opportunity to oversee the kind of performance. Upon resignation or ceasing to be in active service or at the expiry of an acting appointment, a judge is obliged to complete all part head cases and to deliver all reserve judgment as soon as possible and do so such work as the prescribed rate. If there are no prescribed rate, the remuneration does not exceed that of an acting appointment based on the time involved. That's one of the challenges that face the system, is because during there's a need to get acting judge work pressure, whatever, usually the judge president will go and ask an advocate or an attorney to come and be an acting judge. And they act there for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, and they go back to their offices. And there are other matters pending, and become a struggle to get them back to come and do their work. And usually why it's coming back to do their work is because when they come to come and deliver judgment, it will only be a one-day exercise, and for which they will not be paid. And so they will be very reluctant to go back to go and do that particular case. Instead, they'll wait until the appointed acting judge again, so that one day is fitted into a longer period for which they end. So they look at these aspects from their own perspective, but it affects the people. And so that's why we found very important that they've found a way of regulating that aspect, so that judges, when they go out of active service or when they go back to the offices, when they finish their acting stint, they are able to deliver what is required of them, etc. Importantly, whilst all those aspects under 9 are very central and fundamental, we found that the gist of the measurement are put in the note. For example, when you look at note 9A, unnecessary postponement, point taking, undue formality and the like must be avoided. B. Litigants are entitled to judgment as soon as possible. The ideal is to deliver all reserved judgment before the end of the term, failing which aid the next term. So our view is that you may put it in a very nice way in terms of that judge must act promptly, must act reasonably, etc. But there are no reasonably can mean different aspects in terms of different cases, etc. Now, in the law there, they basically give a time frame. They say, when the court adjourns after 3 months for a term, all judgments must have been given. Failing which, they bring up the new term. So they don't start the new term with a backlog. We are of the view that that's a very critical measurement that must form part of the body of the rules, because it's a measurement tool which will enable not only the senior judge but which also enable an ordinary citizen to expect that if my matter started now, I expect that by end of March it should be done after evidence has been given, etc. I cannot wait for judgment, and judgment, there are judgments that have been waited, there are judgments which span over 3 years. Not evidence. People have given evidence, even judgment, and visits are not given, and in some instances they are due to the complexity of the matters at hand, and the judge is struggling to get his or her mind glued on the facts, whatever, says, and goes over and over again, and people get prejudiced and get cost escalated, etc. So this will basically help in terms of taking the process forward, etc. Restraint is very important. It's basically expect of judges to exercise what you call judicial restraint in a way that feeds the decorum and the integrity of the office, so that the judge does not seem to act out of emotions or act in the spur of the moment. Judges are expected to be orderly and expected to manage the process more than people who appear before court. People who are emotional are those who are before court. When people in divorce proceedings are very emotional, murder trials are very emotional, divorce families involves loss of life, etc. And people will understandably be emotional and be very sensational about the issue they deal with, etc. You do not expect judges to step in the frame of those people. You expect them to manage the emotions and make sure people understand and are able to deal with the proceedings as they go on, because issues happen and it takes time. They die off when the people appear to court again. They relieve those issues. When you go to court, you listen to rapes and murder. People deals with issues which have troubled them in the past, etc. And it needs somebody who is properly trained and who can be able to manage the emotions, etc. So a judge has to play this role at the end of the day and be sensitive to the feelings of the people. That's very important. On page 12, we've got a very important one, under 11, association. And this one, the judges prefer. They prefer that, as they say, the judge does not belong to any political party or secret organization, except insofar as it is necessary for the discharge of judicial office. A judge does not become involved in any political controversy or activity. Very important. And over time, and especially a trend in most of the democracies, political disputes are resolved in court, not at a community level, etc. And that's the trend that comes on, etc. And the judges are always found themselves in a position where they have to adjudicate over disputes of a political nature or social nature that affects or involves a political objective or outcome or so. The judges feel that they will be less compromised if they do not if they are not affiliated to any of the parties in a dispute before themselves, etc. Especially from the crucial court perspective and the high court, etc. This issue was debated thoroughly with the Chief Justice, because when we checked from the other national instruments, we found that there is a similar prohibition but worded differently. It does not say that judges must not be law. All it says in other instruments, they say judges must not participate in the political activities, including addressing, attending public meetings, addressing campaigns, all those aspects. They specify them what they may not do because of their delicate position in the judiciary, and because of judicial position of the judiciary in the nature and fabric of the three state branches of government. The judiciary is the ultimate arbiter. It must come when everything else can be resolved between the branches. They must come and resolve them, and in doing so must apply all the constitution and the law. So they must not be influenced by affiliation for their personal levels, etc. Now, Parliament will guide whether it warrants merit to bar membership or to bar political participation by judges, etc. Both of which, from our side, the minister was very happy to be guided by Parliament around those aspects, etc. But as I say, these are new kind of principles which resonate from our kind of democratic dispensation. The other aspect is, if we bar that activity, one effect I needed to allude at the beginning that this code is going to serve as a standard for all judicial officers. So we're going to send to magistrates at some point, because we did not want to, they've got their own code now which is framed similar to that one of the public service, more or less, or so, etc., and which have got its own shortcomings that must be addressed. And the view as part of the single judiciary approach is that same principles, same norms and standards must apply to judicial officers across the board. The constitution, the judicial branch of government comprises of judicial officers in their categories and hierarchy, and therefore it's important that they are subject to the same kind of rules of the game, etc. So if we bar, if the, at the end of the decision is taken to exclude judicial officers from political activity, etc., obviously it should be taken into mind that they extend to entire judiciary, etc. So it may even go to all the must. Perhaps it's not so difficult with 204 judges compared to 2,000 magistrates, etc. So it's one thing that needs to be considered very carefully.
And it may prejudice political parties. They may not have people who are there, members of the like,
yes,
who are there from becoming belonging to political parties.
Yes. There may be a certain area where there are more judicial officers than members of the public, and you, the political person may wish to depend on their vote to get on those aspects. But as I say, I've also expressed the view that belonging is one issue, but participating in a constitutional life, political life, right to vote, right to what, those cannot be taken away from any other person, because they've got their own guarded secrecy in themselves from our constitutional framework, etc. I'm not going to deal with the next aspect of recusal, because it's also governed thoroughly by law. Recusal is when the judge must recuse or excuse himself or herself from a matter in which he or she has a direct or indirect interest, because it will influence the decision, the impartiality of the judge, etc. There are quite extensive authority both in law elsewhere that guides the process, etc. And then the fact that is emphasized here, as I've said, is not harmful to the code. It can just be kept here. But the understanding should be that the code does not rewrite the law with regards to recusal. It can just amplify what the law says. The law still applies in terms of those principles. Of importance is the next one, extrajudicial work in Rule 13. And I would like to give basically a background around this aspect so that it could basically guide the honorable members of the committee on how to deal with it forward. The conditions of service of judges have been designed in a way that enhances the independence, accountability and impartiality of the judicial officers. Judges, unlike members of the executive and members of the legislature and all public office bearers and staff, have a secret of tenure in terms of the remuneration, so that they are not going to be tempted to deal in matters in a way that could benefit or disadvantage them after they have left office. So, as far as remuneration is concerned, the judge remains a judge for life. They don't leave office. They get the salary, which is not a pension, in the sense that they are not paying to the pension fund. They get a salary for life. So they get the very same salary that is determined by the president, approved by this parliament, and they continue to get that salary even after they've attained 65 and 70 years. And upon their passing on, their spouses get a percentage of the salary, 75% of the salary. That's why it's always attractive to be associated with a judge.
It to become a judge, so that even if you have resigned, just continue earning salary.
Now, what the law tried to provide is that once judges have retired from active service, etc., they should still conduct themselves in a way that befits a judicial office, because they remain judges. They still have greatest influence on society. By being a judge, even after you have left office, you will still be consulted. You will still have influence. You can write in the newspapers, whatever. People will still follow your thinking, whatever, etc. So you remain a judge because of the influential position in society. And therefore, the code, you know, in the way the legislation is drafted, apply and extend to retired judges, despite the fact that they are no longer active service. The fact that they are judges and hold the status and the title remains an important aspect in society. There's also a feeling that the law or the code must not make an unnecessary intrusion into the lives of those who have served their term and they are now in retirement at home. I said earlier on that one of the reasons for the regulations to be postponed was because of the need to consider some amendments, because there were some suggestions that once judges have retired, they should not continue disclosing their financial interest, whatever, etc., because they are now at home, and the department may struggle to trace where they are, etc., and all those kind of complications, whatever, etc. But that's a debate for regulations. On the code, there's also a feeling that the provisions applying to retired magistrates should be less stringent than those that apply to judges in active service, mainly in terms of their extrajudicial service, work that they receive, etc. Now, the Act as it is provides that a judge who has retired from active service may receive certain benefit, remuneration or office for profit, but under certain circumstances and contained intended contemplated by the Act to be only in relation to those aspects that do not put into disrepute the judicial officer or not compromise the independence of the judicial officer, etc. Now, when we deal with these other aspects, it's very important that we keep those aspects which are very important, which will basically make sure that the judiciary remains independent. Important around that is sub-rule 8, which indicates that the judge does not sit as a private arbitrator. And in a way which is written here, it requires a judge who is in active service. And a judge may be a director of a Section 21 company because it is not for gain. A judge may be a director of a private family company or a member of a closed corporation, but if the company or closed corporation conduct business, the judge may not perform an executive function. And old rules are very, very, very delicate, very delicate rules. Because we may have the law saying that you may not receive remunerations, whatever, for because your financial aspect are taken care of by state for life. And there may be an indirect receipt of the very same benefits through those corporations, shares and whatever, etc. And those aspects need to be looked at delicately by parliament, etc. We already have a process where judges continue to write books and they receive royalties for the books, which is important to the evolution of jurisprudence, which obviously is something which will be permitted by the minister and acting under the act, etc. Where it becomes challengeable is when it's in relation to our judges who are out of active service. And as I said, there will have to be a fine balance between what the code seeks to prohibit and what the law says. We should guard against providing the code what is not allowed for in terms of legislation. And that will basically require very, very interaction between the code and the legislation, also between the regulations drafted by the minister, which allow certain exemptions in terms of extra remuneration for judges retired in active service, etc. And all I'm saying is that that's going to require that kind of close interaction in finalizing the code, etc. And when you look under Rule 16, on page 70 of the code, they have put basically aspects that relate solely to judges on judges not on active service, that is judges discharged from active service, etc. So it's going to be required of Parliament to be very, very, very meticulous in dealing with those aspects of the code, etc. So these are the rules or the provisions of the code. And as I've indicated, they have been drafted by the judiciary. They reflect the views of the judiciary. We accept those aspects I've raised on in terms of the drafting style and those aspects where the minister is willing to be guided by parliament, etc. We found them to be very, very, very enriching and helpful in terms of accessing justice. And we saw that they form a kind of a starting process. And as and when we continue, we may basically fill the gaps in the code. The Act says that at any given time it may be adopted and amended, and any amendment to the code must be tabled and be approved by Parliament. So we have the view that this code provides a first draft working document that could basically take this country forward. And this basically a brief summary of the code as tabled by the Minister Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, JP Skosana. I think you did well, because I forgot to announce at the beginning that we will require to attend at something like quarter to 12 these proceedings. But we've got ample time. Honorable members, it's time now that you can either make comments or ask questions, etc., etc. I noted Professor Ndabandaba. In other hand, I will learn your names as time goes on. Yeah, I would require that before you speak, maybe just for the sake of familiarizing ourselves with the names, you just introduce yourself and ask questions. Gentlemen, all I can remember is that you said you are from COPE. You are dealing with the code today. That's why I remember that one. Professor Ndabandaba, then the Honorable Lady here, and the gentleman from COPE.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I want to congratulate the Speaker for a very exhaustive and informative disposition. But having said that, my comment is around the big lesson has taught us. Once a judge, always a judge. I wish that all of us here could be judges. Unfortunately, we can't be. Now, Chair, my question for clarity is around belonging to a particular political party versus participating in a particular political party in respect of judges. Now, if we believe in objectivity, how certain can one be that belonging to a particular organization will not prejudice or influence a judge, even if he does not participate fully? I remember my days at university, if you are a professor and you belong to a particular political organization, I don't say I was prejudiced, but you, as a human being, you might be influenced if you are dealing with a student who belongs to your party. Thanks, sir.
At the end of the year, when you mark the scripts.
And during the year also.
And then the next one is Honorable
Arantxa. Yes, what's that? Thanks, Chaperson. Chaperson, in the court, the Honorable presenter said to the judges are not to belong to any or get involved in any political parties. What about the spouses of the judges? Because they also, as he has said, they also get something like 75% from the salaries of the judges or from the government. What does that not going to have any influence on him when he has got somebody in the house who belongs to a political party and who is very much involved in the political party?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just two questions. The one is, acting judges, are they part of this yet? You have two different classes of acting judges. You do have those who act for quite a while, and then you will have acting judges that will go in for 1 month or 2 months and then return to practice. But there is definitely examples where practicing advocates will act for 12 months. I just want to know about that. And then also, in terms of the code as published, a judge cannot sit as a private arbitrator. Why can a retired judge sit then as an arbitrator? I recall that there was criticism in the Cape High Court delivered by a judge that it is not fair when retired judges sit as arbitrators. I'll get the judgment for the committee so that we can look at that more in depth, when it's necessary.
Honorable Landers.
Just two questions, Chair. On page 14, under extrajudicial activities, sub 7 there, it says a judge is not engaged in financial and business dealings. And then it goes on to say that may reasonably be perceived to exploit the judge's judicial position, etc. Now, my question then is, what financial and business dealings can there be that won't be perceived to exploit the judge's judicial position? Because any financial business dealings engaged by the judge may be perceived. So perhaps that one should end with a full stop after the word dealings, but that's just my question. Then on page 15, under the notes 10A, it's not a note, 10, it says, it speaks of the judge may not perform an executive function. What does that mean? It's assumed that everyone understands what an executive function is, but perhaps we can get clarity on what that means, Chippers.
Okay, Ms. Kosana and Mr. Redman, your responses to the questions.
Thank you, Chair. My clarity will basically is based on the interaction we've had with the Chief Justice and the heads of courts. and as I said, they may not reflect entirely what they've explained to us, etc. The issue of political belonging, it's a very sensitive one in the sense that it is expected. It will be expected of churches like being part of society to have preferences or affiliation. The fact that they are not card-carrying members is one issue. Of importance is that when they deal with a particular matter, they have an independent state of mind, and they apply they interpret the matters at hand with reference to the facts and the law. And that's what they should be trained in school. At the end of it, they should be trained that when you deal with matters, you must be able to act independently, impartially, and with all the sensitivity and with equality between the parties before yourselves, etc. That's very paramount. It's one thing that you make, it does not mean that if it's not a cartoon member may basically desist from taking a particular opinion or views in mind. As I say, it's a judge who stays in South Africa, who like us read newspapers, who's got children, who may not deny children, may have children who are going to become very active and come and discuss, who've got spouses, and a child is not a judge, and a child cannot be discriminated by the fact that is born to a judge. You cannot stop the child from becoming the secretary of any political organization if they choose so, etc. And they study at school, they study politics, they influence, they meet with people, etc. And all those aspects are called influences, but it's expected of a judge when matters are before the judge to be able to act independently and to be able to exercise a greatest caution in terms of the issues beforehand and to apply the law. That's why if you read that with all the other codes and the law, that the issue of recusal, you recuse yourself in matters where you've got direct or indirect interest, or you recuse yourself in matters where the outcome will influence your own position, etc. And if in a particular case you feel that, regardless whether you are a cat king or whatever, if you feel you will be so much influenced, you are closer to issues at hand, they don't require you to excuse yourself. That's it. It's as simple as that. If you are a son-in-law of the president of a particular party, DA or Cooper, NC, and the matters beforehand, even if you are a member, the fact that you've got close proximity with the parties at hand suggests that you must accuse yourself. That's the law. You cannot say, no, I'm not a member of DA, but because of them, you can deal with them, and even though you are connected indirectly with the issues at hand, etc. So it must be read in line with this, with the other aspects. But obviously, it will make sense if the emphasis is on a non-participation in political activities. So even if there's belonging, the main important is the participation, which is very critical at the end of the day, etc. But as I said, we stand to be guided by your good sense around this aspect, etc. And to the extent that sponsors live their own independent lives, etc., there's nothing that stops a judge from marrying a person who's in political life. The judge may become married to a premier. Yes. it will be some discrimination if you say, and it will be very sensitive if we're going to extend this thing outside the judges, unlike the financial interest, whatever. It's going to be very, very difficult. As I say, perhaps these are some of the things that will be dealt with on the merits as they come before whatever. You can't basically prescribe them up front, because they may have different permutations at the end of the day. The acting, and linked to the issue of acting judges. Acting judges are drawn from the advocates, and you cannot say for the duration that you are acting you cannot belong to ANC. Because he may be a member of in good standing at the times upon acting, cannot keep on writing to Luthuli House and denounce membership for March until May. Come back in July and says, I'm back again, I'm a member, whatever, etc. It's going to be complicated, etc. Now, the question is, if an acting judge who's appointed for 12 months and that judge comes to deal with issues that affect political disputes, it will be then required of the judge to stand aside because it's closer to the issue. That's why I say this must not be read in isolation. It must be read with all the other aspects, etc. Surely, it's only when judges are appointed permanently that they will be expected to denounce their affiliation and association with certain organizations, etc. And the principle of recusal does not only apply to political parties. It applies if you are a judge, you deal with a matter that involves your school governing board of which you are a member. You must step aside. You cannot, because it's going to compromise your independence, etc. And there was also a sense that there are also other organizations other than the political parties, which are every day in court, etc., and which take particular sides in terms of social life, etc., which may also be influential in terms of judicial participation. So we may have to look deeper into that and see how can we basically assist Parliament with fair information around the benchmarking, the examples, whatever, of other countries, whatever, etc.
On a light note, Ms. Kosana, is it not vice versa that that particular acting judge will be the more qualified because he knows politics? He can tell them about it through the eye of the needle and how the policies are drawn and how the conferences are held and who should be the president or not, you see. No, that was on a light note.
The issue of judges in private and out of service serving as arbitrators has been with us for many, 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 many years. It's a very contentious issue. And there's an expectation and a practice which happens that judges, after they've served their term, 15 years or 20 years, they can basically continue dealing in other functions outside judicial offices for which they get remunerated, etc. That issue happens. It's a reality. It happens, and it needs to be looked at sensitively, and taken the history where we come from, etc. So judges have always served as arbitrators after they've served that term. Remember, in terms of constitution, and a judge of the Constitutional Court serves only 15 years. After 15 years, and these aspects came from the history, because in the past you could only appoint judges after they've served 20 as senior counsels. So by the time the judge comes to the bench, the judge will be very old, would not be an active life. Now today, we take judges from the university, then they're 55 and they've served 15 years. And those judges will come and say, look, but I can't sit. I still want to make a contribution, etc. And that's where the issues come at, etc. So it requires the whole relook of the system moving forward, etc. It's not only a matter which can be resolved only with severance to a code. It needs to be looked at holistically and holistically. And it's an aspect that obviously troubles the ministers in terms of their requests and how to deal with them, etc. The act which has been passed by Parliament and joins the minister to draft guidelines on what may be acceptable aspects over which there may be remuneration. We want just to write books for people to come and study. And for the time that they write books, you expect them to get royalties because they've put energy, they've put time, they've put everything, etc. You want just to go and lecture young lawyers to come and be the examiners. And for that time, you expect them to be compensated for their time and efforts and research, whatever. If you don't do that, they do it overseas. Justice Langa is the judge of appeal in Namibia. And they think they take them. If you don't find use for them, they take your legal minds and use them to write books in Netherlands and such. Now, if you close a total bar, you are basically, you are going to have the whole brain drain in terms of the legal minds, etc. And not everybody would want to sit and do it for nothing. Perhaps that was the era before '94, when people did things for nothing. Today, people, when they want to do something, they want to know what they're going to get in return for that. So there are aspects that need to be articulated very sensitively and very cautiously, looking into the interest of society and the judiciary as a whole. What I can read to be referred to that the judge may not participate in executive, may not hold executive, is basically that a judge may not, in a family trust or family business, be the CEO or be the perform those functions that resonates with decision making of an executive nature on his or her part. And that's what they basically explain, that to the extent that a judge may be a member of trust, a member of whatever, that judge should not hold a prominent role or position that will require of him or her to engage publicly with other institutions, with government, whatever. Imagine if you are Minister of Agriculture, so you are meeting somebody who's representing a private sector, they are coming to ask for money, and they are coming by a charge, the CEO. You find it very difficult to say no because of the stage and position and record of this person, etc. That's the indication that they should not be in the public life, in the position that puts them in the public domain. They can act as members or sleeping members of the kind of public concern, etc. But as I said, most of these aspects are going to become clearer through practice, and there's going to be a need for many, many amendments as we move forward, because it will not be a perfect document from the beginning itself. I would not basically, I would agree with Honourable Member Landers in terms of the provision that relates to financial interest and reformulation of that sentence, so that it is perfect. It does appear that it needs to be tweaked to convey the intention is sought to be conveyed. We did also acknowledge that there are still certain typos and grammatical aspects that needs to be factored into the report, and we hope and trust that that should be part of this process. Advocate Ratman have agreed to me that he started the process of going through it to clean those aspects so that we can have a cleaner version in terms of the language, etc., of the instrument. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks. I think the upper house is now driving you towards conclusion. Are there any further questions that the members would want to ask, or any clarities? Yes. Let me just check how many of you. It's one. Three.
Judge being a director of a private family company or a member of a close corporation, would Mr. Sosana agree that that should be declared? And we should also determine to whom and where that declaration must be made. And the final thought on this matter is whether such declaration should also be made public, so that everyone is aware of these things. And presently, none of us know. We just told Mr. J.B. Sivanyoni as a judge, and as far as we're concerned, the man is as innocent as an angel in the nature of fact. He belongs to several directorships and so on. And quite often you find
an example.
Yes, an example.
Yeah.
Well, not this JVC, but you need the other one. And so when you do find out, Chairperson, it's too late.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's just the clarity on number 16, judge is not on active service. Can you clarify section 1 in relation to section 6?
Okay. Thanks, Chairperson. Yeah, whilst we're dealing with these issues, I just want to check whether judges are also not getting things like gifts. And let's say I'm excited, my case has been well conducted, and I'm happy about the outcome of the case, and I want to thank the judge. Is that allowed, or why did we not put it here on the code of conduct purposely, or what?
Maybe let me check if there are any other questions, because I hope this will be the last questions for this session, because we're closer to quarter to 12. If there is none, can we get the answers? Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. I do agree that, hence I spend time when I try to explain that aspect relating to extrajudicial income must be dealt with very delicately. Because that's where most of these aspects hide themselves in, and the day the regulations get passed, and the day we get the first direction for judges, we are likely to see more that we did not anticipate that existed, etc. And this is a very important revolutionary kind of legislation, because it basically intends to say if you rule in a judge that involves APSA and Telkom, involving very massive aspects of shares, etc., and when it emerged more than in fact you got shares in Telkom, it will create a very havoc. Even though you may have applied your mind independently, etc., the fact that you are closer to the issues at hand, and that was not declared, it will create a very, very serious perception of impartiality, of bias at the end of the day. Hence, I think they need to be managed with care, and hence they are going to open up the system. And then we also go to the issue of gifts, whatever, etc. I said when I started, judicial officers are the only people who do not declare now, etc. They're not required to pay anything, etc. And that will become clearer once they start declaring. Even those who may have received funds and cars long time ago, etc. The fact that that's not known is good. But the fact that we'll start from a clean slate moving forward, that those things are not known, I think will create more credibility of the judicial system at the end of the day. So, I agree. And we did express our view as well that look, there's no way we can avoid the issue of disclosure, and whether the arguments whether it should be extended to the wife, must not go to uncle, whatever, that bridge will be crossed. But the issue, the sooner we come that aspects, the better for the accountability of the system, etc. So the code will be read to build the regulations around those aspects, and also what needs to be public, because some of the things will need to be public for purposes of adjudication, whatever, for purposes of public confidence in the entire system that appeared before. Look, on page 16, madam, in terms of judges out of active service, number one, restate basically what the Act says. But I think what they attempt to do in number six is the qualification. In number one, the view is that a judge who's out of active service not entitled to receive any remuneration apart from the salary, whatever, which is what the law says. But in 6, there's a sentence which says a judge is charged not involved in business, blah, 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 and other activities incompatible with the status of a judge. So they say there's an attempt to basically qualify that if the remuneration, whatever you receive, is compatible with the office, there's nothing wrong with it. But if it's incompatible, you cannot receive it. And that's a grey area where we still require a legislative intervention by the minister. The minister is required by law to develop guidelines to regulate those aspects where permission may be given in terms of certain aspects, etc. And hence I've said earlier on that the court will have to interface with the process, which is currently ongoing around that. We'll basically keep this ad hoc committee abreast in terms of those guidelines and where we are in drafting them, because they go hand in hand with this process. As I've said, gifts need to be declared, and it may be very important to put something on gifts in the code. It's very important. There are other aspects which are missing. That, for example, one of the critical aspects which we may find is a need to articulate them is the whole issue around the media. And the judicial restraint in terms of responding or taking to other branches of government. All these things we take to account, they never happen. But you cannot expect one branch of government in the media publicly announce and denounce the other branch of government, because the Constitution in Chapter 3 basically tried to provide a mechanism how disputes within the branches and within the spheres can be dealt with, without basically throwing them in the public domain. As I've said, those are the aspects that can still be improved on the code. And we've thought that once Parliament have the same views of the judiciary, there may be a process which can then suggest what other aspects that may need to be added on the code, so that when there's an interaction with the judiciary, there's a kind of an improved aspect that relates to that. From our side, we can basically share with yourselves what aspects which would, from the governance perspective, may need to be reflected just to regulate the effectiveness and the interaction of the three branches of government. And even if we don't do it now, it's a process that can be dealt with through the amendments moving forward, etc. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you. I think before we conclude, it will be important that the administration just assist members, because I know today the situation was slightly chaotic because members did not know where to go, did not get all the information around the meeting itself and everything else. I think if the administration can just assist us with the venue for tomorrow, what time do we start, and all that, before we conclude this meeting.
Okay, thanks. We are meeting in V4-5 tomorrow, starting at 9, public hearings.
No, thank you. Let me then hand over to my co-chairperson to conclude and adjourn this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, comrade, my co-chairperson. Ladies and gentlemen, we take this time and say thank you very much to all of you. That was the briefing from the Department of Justice. Professor, just one comment on your comment to say maybe we may all...